Good morning. First case today is United States v. Carpenter. Is the appellant prepared to argue? Is the government prepared? Okay. Appellant may argue.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Carpenter. I am here along with Major Alan Abrams on behalf of the appellant, Senior Airman Carpenter. This is a case about a 13-year-old kid, J.M., that was not a 13-year-old kid. In fact, he was skilled in deceiving adults that he was much older than his true age. And the tactics that he employed, based on the evidence in this case, were such that, as he admits, in JA-188, he got adults to believe that he was not a minor.
He was in fact 13.
He was in fact
13. At the pertinent time.
That is correct. The central issue in this case was mistake of fact. Mistake of fact as to age, specifically. Of course, as all the court members know, mistake of fact concerns mens rea. In the case of mistake of fact as to age in this case, the mens rea pertained to both an honorable and a reasonable mistake of fact. In discerning the honorable and reasonable mistake of fact, the military judge erroneously concluded, as a matter of law, that in order for evidence to relate to the mistake of fact pertaining to reasonableness, the objective standard, as a condition precedent, the appellant must know of the proffered evidence at the time of the alleged offenses in order for it to be relevant. During the case, government counsel had submitted photos of J.M. These photos depict J.M. in the words of the lower court, specifically the Air Force Court, in a way that made him appear younger. And of course, the defense submitted photos that made him appear older in JA-50. This is discussed. The issue was also argued by trial counsel in rebutting the notion that appellant's mistake of fact as to reasonableness was credible, by arguing specifically that the internet was one thing, but it's another thing to be fooled when it is staring you right in the face. These government photos that were offered as related mistake of fact pertaining to the prong of objectiveness, again, were never seen by the appellant. It is paradoxical, therefore, under that circumstance, as it pertains to mistake of fact, that the military judge then precluded any cross-examination by the defense counsel as it related to these other instances of deception, manipulation, persuasion, and convincing pertaining to JM's ability to convince these other individuals that he indeed was not a minor.
Well, that all took place after these events? his snookering, or allegedly snookering, these other guys.
It was, Your Honor, it was actually
temporarily later.
Negative, sir. It was actually before. It was in August of 2013. These incidents happened in September and November of, as charged in those months in 2013. There are actually two sets. There were the ones that he snookered at the beginning, which, based on the record, was at least three, maybe more, and those that he snookered after the fact. He was very good at snookering.
Okay.
In fact, the CCA got it wrong on that point, didn't they?
Correct. That is correct, sir.
Well, that's maybe why I've got it wrong. So there's snookering before and snookering after, and then snookering the accused.
Yes, sir. He was the one in between all the snookering.
Okay.
So in terms of the evidence before the military judge knew that the minor had initiated the contact. The military judge knew that the minor had misrepresented his age, knew that the minor had engaged in sexual encounters with other males, and knew about the Skype account. Why was this evidence that was sought to be introduced by the defense at court-martial not cumulative?
Because, sir, it pertains to mistake of fact as to reasonableness and not honesty.
Does it matter that we judge a lone trial?
According to the record, this judge took some time during the course of his deliberations in coming to his conclusion. I would like, if I could, Your Honor, address that specific issue because, as the court is well aware, even though he was snookered in between, and perhaps that may or may not have been relevant, obviously it's the appellant's position that it was, and there should have been at least some cross-examination because there is a blanket prohibition, cross-examination in that regard. I would like to talk about the evidence in the case, if I may. The evidence in the case, as the court looks at the five factors under Van Arsdale, certainly the first factor dealing with the importance of the witness testimony for the trial counsel as it relates to mistake of fact. The evidence in this case presented by the trial counsel was evidence that essentially came from the words of J.M. Now, I understand government counsel could certainly argue, well, there are some admissions, et cetera, with regards to the pounding heart of a young man who's been faced with the fact that he's potentially subject, even though he's not a lawyer, to strict liability in the eyes of OSI, and saying things, thinking to himself that under the circumstances, I might be in a lot of trouble, and I certainly don't want to admit to that. So, yes, he was not very forthcoming. Despite that fact, it is also very clear that when government counsel talked about the fact at trial that there's no issue of credibility, that is disingenuous because the whole point of snookering is credibility. J.M. was not credible. But the larger issue under Van Arsdale, I believe, is the issue related to the presence or absence of evidence corroborating or contradicting the witness and the overall strength of the prosecutor's case. What was the evidence? The evidence in this case essentially came down to three areas. The first were the photos, and I've already mentioned that. The second was the physicality, because in order for somebody to discern whether or not somebody is of a particular age or not, certainly how they appear is part of it. Perception is reality, and that is certainly arguably an objective part of it. The evidence in this case was that J.M., based on J.A. 44 through 47, was 5 feet.
Counsel, before you get into more details on the facts, which are in the record before us, can I steer you back more to legal arguments?
Yes, sir.
On page 13 of your brief, you make an argument, and some of it is in bold. So I assume you feel it's important, and I don't understand it. So I want to read what you wrote, and if you could tell me the point you were trying to convey. It says, the Air Force Court's rationale highlights the error in its reasoning. If cross-examination on the topic would have been futile because the victim would not be able to testify about his paramour's subjective beliefs, then by implication, the victim's paramour's subjective beliefs would have been relevant. What's the point that you were trying to convey there about the relevance of the paramour's subjective beliefs?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, as it relates to the subjective belief, the reason why there is a discussion pertaining to MRE 412 Bravo 1 Charlie was that the perception of JM pertaining to those paramour's beliefs was important. And it is also part and parcel of the fact, as I've stated before, that he believed, as I mentioned before, that he had snookered these other two individuals. And that belief is certainly relevant. I believe what the Air Force Court was trying...
Who believed?
He believed, yes.
Who's he?
He would be JM.
Okay.
That would be JM, Your Honor. The point is I believe the Air Force Court was saying, look, defense counsel, you are arguing for the relevance of this testimony based on pure speculation on behalf of JM. That is subjective opinions is all you're asking for, and that's really not relevant, and it's pure speculation. In the appellant's view, that misses the mark, and that's why those words were written, because the point is that he is an individual that has the ability to discern, certainly, JM, whether or not he has snookered somebody or not. And that is certainly relevant as it pertains to...
Did the defense counsel have an opportunity to talk to the victim prior to the court-martial?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why shouldn't this be viewed then with the motion made before the military judge as a classic fishing expedition? Why shouldn't the defense counsel have nailed this down and been able to say to the military judge, I want the victim to be able to testify because the victim will testify that in having sex with these other adult males, the other adult males, upon discerning that I was a minor, discontinued our contact. Instead, what the defense counsel is doing at trial is saying, I want to ask all these questions with no real proffer about what the victim will actually respond.
Well, and following up on Judge Olson, it doesn't seem to me to be a lead pipe certainty that the reactions of the other males show they were snookered. It may simply show that, well, hell, I've gone this far, and here he is. So, you know, isn't that equally likely?
Sir, Your Honor, with regards to the equal likeliness of things, I certainly would not term it a fishing expedition. There's evidence in the record of the fact that JM believed that he had, as we talked about, snookered or deceived, what have you, two other individuals with regards to his actual age.
Okay, he believed it.
Yes, he believed it. So it's not as though we're just throwing anything out there. Now, why is it that the ADC did not go forward and lay this all out? Judge Olson,
that's my point. Why didn't the defense counsel tee this up for the military judge and say, I'm making this proffer to you, Judge, that if I am permitted to explore these avenues, this is the information that I'm going to be able to elicit, which would have provided the military judge with a much more informed basis to decide here. And since we're dealing with an abuse of discretion standard, that's important.
Yeah, and I understand that within that context, Justice Olson. However, the fact of the matter is the military judge had decided against the defense providing any of this cross-examination based on the fact that the mistake of fact reasonableness prong could not be satisfied by evidence that the appellant didn't know about. So I think the judge was going to get there anyway with regards to the abuse of discretion. I frankly believe that's a different question. I don't think it changes the dynamic of what the issue is here, which is that the military judge categorically misunderstood the law as it related to the mistake of fact pertaining to the second prong of reasonableness.
Yeah, I share Judge Olson's concern that there was a written motion, there was argument on the motion, and the theory that you're arguing never was really developed on the record, was it?
Well, there was a stipulation of fact that was submitted.
No, I don't mean that, but to admit it for the purpose of showing, I have a little different take on it, but you show that he engaged in sex with six other people by convincing them he was of age. That was his method of operation, his MO, his identity, his disguise, whatever you want to call it. And the fact that the accused didn't know about it had nothing to do with it. It's what he did that would be important. It seems like he should have been able to explore what the victim did on each of these occasions to try to convince him. And that he would know. He would know what he did.
Right. Exactly right, Your Honor. The fact of the matter is that inquiry was made after the ADCs had filed the 412 motion, and the ADCs had essentially argued that these other instances were such that it would go to reasonableness pertaining to the mistake of fact. And there was this stipulation of fact, and they said we should be able to get into this, particularly again in light of the fact that JM actually said, yeah, I duped him.
Were the other Air Force personnel that engaged in sex with this young man prosecuted?
There was, Justice Ryan, there was one individual, Kilgard, who had actually testified during the course of the court-martial that I understand was prosecuted. However, Kilgard's encounter with JM was in December of 2013 after the fact.
Do you know if he raised a mistake of fact defense, and if so, do you know if it was successful?
I do not know, Justice Ryan. I apologize. I could certainly provide supplemental briefing in that regard to the extent the court believes that this is something that the court absolutely needs to know.
Counsel, since Judge Cox raised the issue that this was a judge-alone trial, does that matter in our calculation here along the following lines? The military judge, he's the finder of fact, and he is concluding that he doesn't need this information to make his ruling in this case. Does that factor into any additional deference we should provide to the military judge's determination on the motion?
Justice Olson, with regards to that question, it was an abuse of discretion by the military judge, and it is very unique for it to be a judge-alone circumstance, and obviously I give you that. But the problem, again, was that this judge was mistaken as to what the applicable law was. In other words, he self-constrained himself with regards to what he could consider. And if I could just very quickly get back to the fact that in the defense's view, the appellate's view, this was a very, very close case. As I stated before, there were photos that were submitted in this particular case. Some of them show that he was young at age, and some show that he wasn't. His physical appearance was such that he looked as though he was also older. There's also this discussion about housing, about the fact that at the time of this incident in Kadena, JM was living with friends temporarily. And even the trial counsel had said at the very end, even if the appellant believes this to be true, it doesn't necessarily explain, you know, the facts and circumstances as it relates to the suspicion. And then there's this big discussion about the fact of what I term don't ask, don't tell paranoid behavior with regards to the fact that JM didn't want to be found out and he didn't find it particularly unusual that is, the appellant didn't find it particularly unusual that JM acted in a certain closeted type of way. There was simply no...
Russell, you're running over.
Yeah, I am. I apologize.
I have one quick question. Is it true that JM had braces? Was wearing braces at the time of this encounter? I mean, reading his testimony, it seemed as though...
JM had, I believe, Justice Ryan...
Judge or judges?
Judge, I'm sorry, Judge, I apologize. He had, according to the record, he was cross-examination by the ADC with regards to the fact he didn't mention that to OSI. I understand during closing that there was no dental records or what have you that were submitted to confirm that fact. But, you know, with all due respect, people who are older than the age of 15 wear braces as well. I appreciate the court's question, however. Thank you. I have nothing further at this juncture.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Ronnie Steelman, and I, along with Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, represent the United States in this proceeding. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in limiting appellant's ability to question JM about his sexual interactions and encounters with other men of whom appellant had no knowledge. This evidence was neither relevant, material, nor probative to the fact finder, and therefore did not fall within the constitutional exception to MRE 412.
Why is it not relevant? The issue here, really the heart of this case, was the objective reasonableness of the
Correct.
Belief. So even though the government's argument is that the accused did not know of these other interactions with minor, why isn't it relevant that a number of other men, and I'm saying for the sake of argument, that these men were not interested in having sex with a 13-year-old boy, they believed he was of age. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't that be relevant to show the objective reasonableness of appellant thinking that the minor was actually of age?
So I've got three answers to that, Judge Olson. First of all, appellant's entire argument rests upon this assumption that these other men who had encounters with JN had this mistake of fact. But as has been pointed out, the defense never presented that evidence in the first place.
Okay, but we're dealing here with a very important defense. You've got a judge-alone trial. Why couldn't the military judge have said, okay, counsel, I'm going to put you on a short leash. I'm going to let you pursue this for a short period of time to see whether the victim can shed any light on this. We talk about cumulative evidence, trial within a trial, waste of time. But in this instance, this could have taken a very short period of time for a military judge to permit the defense counsel to pursue this.
I think regardless of that, Your Honor, I think that doesn't have any relevance to the reasonable person standard. An appellant misinterprets the reasonable person standard in this case.
Tell me what the reasonable person standard is in the government's formulation.
Yes, Your Honor. The question that the fact finder had before him was whether a reasonable person in appellant's position, namely somebody who was seeing what appellant saw, hearing what appellant heard, and knowing what appellant knew, whether that person would have a mistake of fact as to JM's age.
And how on earth isn't this relevant, to repeat Judge Olson?
I mean, if all these other people are in the same position, seeing the same thing, and making the same decision, why isn't their belief or lack thereof relevant to what an objective person would have believed?
Well, the defense never presented any evidence that these people were seeing the exact same thing that appellant saw and hearing the same thing.
Well, they didn't present anything because they couldn't.
Well, they also didn't present anything in the motions argument to support. The defense had the burden in that case to assert why this evidence was relevant.
If JM had used a particular disguise in each one of these cases to convince him that he was of age, would that be relevant if he used that same disguise as appellant, even though appellant didn't know about the other?
No, Your Honor, I still wouldn't say that would be relevant in that situation.
Well, are you familiar with Rule of Evidence 404?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
Modus Your Honor. Operandi, that type of evidence, can't you admit? If a burglar came in wearing a bandana and five straight victims?
Your Honor, I...
You could identify the burglar that way?
Yes, Your Honor, and I see that evidence that coming in as far as kind of government presenting evidence of motive.
But
and
didn't he use like that? But an internet disguise in this case?
I mean, yes, Your Honor. He said there's Craigslist. He used Craigslist to obtain the.
And from the government's contact. Position, though, wasn't JM able to present that to Kelgard? Didn't Kelgard keep his Skype or something? Am I got that?
Yes,
wrong?
Your Honor. So the facts are essentially that the appellant. Had a conversation with Senior Airman Kelgard at some point, and the appellant forwarded his Skype conversation to Airman Kelgard, and the government obtained that through.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood the facts. I thought Kelgard had saved his.
What Airman Kelgard had saved was the actual conversation with appellant in this case that JM had held.
Okay, back to the beginning. Why isn't it relevant?
Again, Your Honor, it's because it's not relevant because it's not the appellant did not see these interactions, and so it cannot inform what a reasonable person in appellant's
position. Well, it seems to me that you're dealing with a reasonable person standard, and that cuts totally the other way.
If 70 people see something and believe X, you don't think that that's relevant to what an objective person would believe because he didn't know what they thought?
No, Your Honor. And also in this case, we're dealing with these people are the most biased possible group that we could have, essentially, to be reporting on this. I mean, these individuals, that had encounters with JM, had every
not
reason.
Relevant because they might lie?
Yes, Your Honor.
What are you saying?
The point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is that these individuals had every reason to make JM think that they believed his age. They certainly weren't going to go up to JM and say, oh, we know you're 13, but we're going to do this anyway. They're going to act in front of JM.
Counsel, back to Judge Olson's line of inquiry. Isn't the government's strongest position in this case is there's nowhere that the defense counsel tried to develop this theory for admissibility?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that probably would be our strongest argument, definitely.
If you read his written motion, this theory is not in there anywhere, is it?
No, Your Honor. The evidence isn't there. And additionally, on top of that, the defense sought to introduce this testimony through JM. That would have been complete speculation on JM's part. Essentially, they were seeking to.
Do you think that they could have forced these people to testify, potentially incriminating themselves?
They could have received immunity. And again, I still don't believe, even if they had gotten these people here, I don't believe that would have still been relevant. But very even much more so. Through JM is definitely the wrong person to bring this evidence through. The fact that he thought that these other people thought that he was actually the age that he told them was.
What about if the question had been factually presented? What did you do? Did you try to convince them you were of legal age? Yes. How did you do it? Isn't that relevant?
No, Your Honor, I still don't believe that would still be relevant. Again, going back to my point about the reasonable person standard.
The next question, that's exactly what you did in this case.
Correct. I understand your point, Your Honor, but I still don't believe that evidence would be relevant. I disagree on that point. Moving on, appellant also argues in his brief that. Well, let me back up just a little bit. The appellant's argument essentially rests entirely on the word if. If these other men were tricked, if JM presented himself in the same way, and if JM looked the same. But essentially, again, go back to the point that evidence was not presented. The defense had the burden on this motion, and they simply did not present that evidence. To the contrary, there was a OSI interview. JM's OSI interview was presented as evidence during the motions hearing by the government in the case. And within that OSI interview, JM even admits and states that many of these men didn't really believe him. He talks about one of the individuals who JM accidentally let it slip that he lived with his parents. One of these individuals, JM, talks about how they had gone off.
How many millennials live with their parents?
Probably a lot, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is a situation where JM is presenting himself to this airman as an airman who lives on that base, who probably most presumably wouldn't be living with his parents at Kadena Air Base in Okinawa. One of these other individuals, appellant, mentioned how he had to, in order to get back on base because they had gone to an off-base hotel, he had to hand his dependent ID card to this man who had to then give it to the gate guard to be able to get onto the base, which presumably would have raised some questions, one would think. So the evidence wasn't there. Appellant also argues that questioning JM about the lies he told would go towards his credibility. But JM's credibility wasn't really at issue in this case. This wasn't a case where the defense was going to be to make JM out to be a liar. 99% of what JM testified to was corroborated by appellant himself. So JM's credibility was not really the issue in this case. Neither is this a case where...
Your argument would be that this evidence would be not relevant regardless of Military Rule of Evidence 412, which would normally exclude this kind of evidence unless it was constitutionally required. If this was not 412 evidence, it still wouldn't be relevant. Is that right? Or are you taking some comfort that there's a higher standard under 412?
No, Your Honor, I would agree with that. I would agree that even outside of 412, this still would not be relevant evidence. I think 412 adds an extra layer onto that. Obviously, the purpose of Military Rule of Evidence, one of the purposes of MRE 412, is to protect these victims from things just like this. Yes, Your Honor. And this isn't a situation, again, this going back to... this is also not a situation where we've gotten the Gray case, where it's a major issue on the case whether this person is believable at all. We don't have that in this case. We've got the chats that JM provided. We can see that JM had extensive sexual knowledge. That's not an issue
well,
in this
yeah,
case.
I mean, this is all kind of irrelevant because... Yeah, this isn't the kind of guy the rule was formulated to protect.
And here's another question. If the purpose of the rule is to protect someone, and the person for whom protection the rule exists is willing and to testify and provides a stipulation of expected testimony and recreates the Skype chats, why invoke the rule?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, JM was a 13-year-old kid at this time. He did not have the capacity under the law to consent.
Presumably his parents had to permit him to speak to defense counsel, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Presumably, yes, Your Honor. But that doesn't mean that he's still not, you know, we don't need to protect him from having to talk about...
What are we protecting him from?
From having to talk about these embarrassing details that aren't relevant.
He certainly didn't seem embarrassed.
Your Honor,
I'm just saying, the purpose is to protect people from having to talk about things, I think, that they don't want to talk about.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because we don't want them to be reluctant to talk about them, you know, to disclose that bad things have happened for fear of having their whole life revealed.
Correct,
right?
Yes, Your Honor.
If they're happy to reveal their whole life, why keep it out?
I don't think the facts in this case set, I mean, I don't think that...
Can you answer my question? I mean, just in the abstract.
Yes, Your Honor. So, for example, you brought up the stipulation of expected testimony.
I'm asking a question about, leave this case aside, if the purpose of the rule is to protect people from having to disclose information that would embarrass them, and they are willing on their own to reveal it, why is the rule, why use the rule?
Well,
what purpose does the rule serve?
There's also a purpose to avoid going down roads that aren't going to be relevant, that are going to be confusing the issues, things like that.
Well, before we had this rule, it was pretty common in rape cases, for example, to try to paint the victim as being a bad person.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. And I think that applies here too, Your Honor.
Another reason 412 was enacted.
Correct. Thank you very much. I agree. I think that's another reason in this case, again, to keep the defense from being able to kind of use that sort of tactic. Not saying that they would have, but it's a protection against that, being able to just say, hey, this person's a liar, he's a bad person, and therefore, you know, believe the appellant. I'm going to talk just very briefly on the prong of materiality that is required under the test that we look at for this evidence.
If it's irrelevant, does materiality matter?
No. It's got to meet all of the prongs. It's got to meet each of the prongs.
Ahead.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
The military judge. The defense counsel was able. The defense was able to put on a mistake of fact defense. This ruling by the military judge did not limit them from completely preclude them from putting on this defense. They were able to put on a very effective mistake of fact defense based on JM's testimony, based on appellant's testimony, what they saw and what they heard. The military judge, you will see, in his ruling, he even allowed them to get into some of this evidence when it was necessary to the defense. For example, the defense was allowed by the military judge to elicit testimony from JM about his encounter with Senior Airman Kelgard, which occurred after the encounter with the appellant. And they were able to use that evidence. They were able to talk about this encounter, what happened during this encounter, and able to show that there might have been some confusion, that JM might have been confusing his encounter with Airman Kelgard with the encounter with the appellant. And the military judge allowed them to get into that with JM and cross-examine him on that for that point of potential confusion. And so what that shows is that the military judge was appropriately tailoring his ruling under an abuse of discretion, and this is in an abuse of discretion standard context. The military judge was carefully tailoring his ruling to ensure that the defense was not being precluded from putting on any kind of a defense that they wanted to put on. If there are no further questions from the court, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
Any evidence about JM's interactions with other men unknown to appellant has no possible relevance to the question of whether a reasonable person in appellant's position would have a mistake of fact as to JM's age. This is the exact type of evidence which MRE 412 is meant to exclude, and the military judge did not abuse his discretion in doing so. The United States respectfully requests this court affirm appellant's finding and sentence as adjudged. Thank you.
Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Government counsel has talked about the fact that there was some evidence in the record pertaining to cross-examination of JM related to Airman Kelgard. The military judge made it very clear that his decision as to the admissibility of that evidence had nothing to do with mistake of fact. For government counsel to talk about United States versus Gray, which for the record has got a lot more to do with the attempt of counsel in Gray to meaningfully impeach the recollection of an alleged a victim in that case related to STDs and the fact that maybe under the circumstances, as I recall, they were confused, which is a whole different issue. Again, this is mistake of fact as to age. That is why, again, those photos came in this particular case. And for government counsel to state that there was any meaningful opportunity provided the ADCs in the United States versus Senior Airman Carpenter to cross-examine with regards to the fact that objective evidence of how someone is able to deceit, convince, and arguably entrap another individual is relevant in the blanket prohibition, in this case, beyond...
But you see, the problem that, I mean, we don't mean to beat you over the head with this, but you know, the problem is you didn't write this motion, and that's not what it says. I mean, what it says is, basically, we want to do this to show that his that it was believable that this person was older because he was sexually experienced. Right, and so don't you have to believe, you can believe that he actually did flirt with the accused and initiate the sexual contact because he did it before. I mean, it had nothing to do with, and they believed him too.
Correct.
I mean, the motion relies on Gray.
Yes, and that was the ADC
really
focus.
The government for talking about Gray when that was the basis.
Absolutely, but it doesn't change the law. And the law is mistake of fact as it pertains to reasonableness still applied under the circumstances. And there was a stipulation of fact that was submitted from JM that specifically talked about the facts and circumstances pertaining to the duping that was going on prior to this incident, which goes directly to the central issue in this case, which was mistake of fact. Based on the circumstances as therefore presented in this case, request that this very honorable and I professionally want to say thank you. This is the honor of my life in 22 years or so. The nature of mistake of fact is dependent on the nature of the charge. When a minor deceives others about his true age, thereafter resulting in a sexual encounter, which is important for the nexus pertaining to this case, the appellant is constitutionally empowered to cross-examine the minor to show that the appellant's subjective mistake of fact as to the minor's age was objectively reasonable. This was a total and complete prohibition to get into any of that evidence. And under the facts in this case, millennials have braces, millennials live with their parents.
Counsel.
Okay, I'll cut it. Thank you, sir. I will.
Thank you, counsel.
I will rest. Thank you.
Case is submitted. Court will be in recess until 10:25.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:25.